coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Joe Palca reporting. At least 16 Palestinians were killed and hundreds injured by Israeli security forces confronting one of the largest Palestinian demonstrations in recent years along the Israel-Gaza border. Riyad Mansour is the Palestinian ambassador to the United Nations.
These peaceful demonstrators posed no threats whatsoever to Israel or its heavily armed soldiers. Yet, its trigger-happy soldiers used live ammunition, tear gas, and rubber bullets to shoot indiscriminately at those non-violent protesters who were demonstrating inside the Gaza Strip near their side of the well-fortified barrier that separates them from Israel.
Israel accuses militants of carrying out attacks under the cover of protests. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called for an independent and transparent investigation into the deadly clashes. A roadside bomb blast has taken the lives of two members of the U.S.-led coalition in Syria, one American and the other British. Five others were wounded. In the meantime, President Trump says the U.S. is on its way out of Syria. Now, the U.S. has more than 2,000 military personnel in Syria, 60 of whom have been killed since the campaign to destroy Islamic State began in 2014. Voters in Sierra Leone are at the polls today for a runoff presidential election after 16 candidates failed to clinch the 55% of votes necessary to win in the first round earlier this month. Voters are casting their ballots for either the ruling party presidential candidate or an opposition candidate, Julius Mahada Bio. This is VOA News. Afghanistan is preparing for much-delayed elections now set for October. Members of parliament and local district officials will be on the ballots. Senior election officials say much needs to happen quickly to meet an October deadline. The Kremlin has given marching orders to so-called unfriendly diplomats from several Western countries in retaliation for the collective Western expulsion of Russian diplomats. More from Reuters' Matthew LaRotonda.
Russia has now fulfilled its promise to retaliate against the expulsion of scores of its own diplomats from Western countries by doing the same in kind. In rapid succession on Friday morning, the ambassadors of countries ranging from the Netherlands to Australia were summoned to the foreign ministry in Moscow. They arrived moments from each other. The ministry says they were handed notes of protest. Several told Reuters afterwards that they'd been given only days to prepare for some, but not all, of their diplomats to leave the country. It came a day after Russia announced it was expelling 60 American officials.
Reuters' Matthew LaRotonda reporting. Pope Francis presided over solemn Good Friday services amid tight security at Rome's Colosseum for the Via Crucis procession. Italian police and army soldiers were on high alert, with Holy Week coinciding with a spate of arrests of suspected Islamic extremists around Italy. Sabina Castelfranco has more for VOA.
Pope Francis presided at a traditional candlelit Way of the Cross procession around Rome's ancient Colosseum. 20,000 people turned out to take part in the event with the Pope. Rome authorities increased security this year, with checks carried out as the faithful approached the area. At the end, he delivered a meditation of his own, denouncing those who seek power, money, and conflict.
La vergogna perché le nostre generazioni.
Pope Francis also said many should feel shame because our generations are leaving young people a world that is fractured by divisions and wars, a world devoured by selfishness, where young people, children, the sick and the elderly are marginalized. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
On Holy Saturday in the evening, the Pope will celebrate the solemn Easter Vigil in St. Peter's Basilica, followed by the joyful Easter Sunday Mass marking Christ's resurrection. Catholic churches in Colombia have donated a 250,000 communion wafers to congregations in neighboring Venezuela, where a food crisis has led to shortages of the holy bread. Venezuela's food shortages have affected churches' ability to get ingredients to make communion wafers. Venezuela's economic crisis, fueled by a decline in oil production, has led to shortages of many staple food items. Joe Palca, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
Sierra Leone should go out and vote because it is their right. It's their right to select their leader, their next president for the next 5 years. They should go out and exercise that right.
Sierra Leoneans choose their new leader in a presidential runoff election Saturday.
Today, they're speaking about millions. The corruption is so high that today they are talking among themselves, you know, who has stolen more than the other.
Angolans urge President João Lourenço to continue with the fight against corruption.
If the election were to happen in a credible way, transparent way, I would say the current presidential majority will become a minority.
And a new survey shows a majority of Congolese have a negative opinion of President Joseph Kabila. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Sierra Leoneans choose their next leader in a presidential runoff election Saturday. It comes after all of the presidential candidates failed to garner the 55% of the total vote cast constitutionally required to win the March 7 poll. In today's runoff election, former Foreign Minister Samura Kamara from the ruling All People's Congress, or APC, faces a stiff competition from former military ruler Brigadier Julius Madabew from the main opposition Sierra Leone People's Party, or SLPP. For more about the presidential runoff, I reach Mohamed Mfali Conte, chairman for the Sierra Leone National Electoral Commission.
Well, this election, well-planned elections, credible elections. We've done all the preparations, distributed all election materials, i.e. ballot papers and other sensitive materials. So they should expect well-planned elections, credible elections. I'll encourage all Sierra Leoneans just to go and vote where they registered.
Well, Mr. Chairman, has the Electoral Commission been able to resolve any concerns that the two major parties have before the elections?
Well, yes. Actually, we've been meeting with the political parties since the release of the elections for the first round. We've been meeting with them. I mean, I think we've now reached the consensus, even though there are sticky issues, the consensus on the tallying, right? So I think there is now a consensus, really, even though, I mean, some of them may not be happy, but there is a consensus.
How about the issue of protecting the vote, preventing intimidation, allowing people to go to the polls to vote without any fear of intimidation or violence?
Well, we are working with the police. We're cooperating with the police. Right, of course, the MACP, that's military aid to civil power, has been invoked just to ensure that there is security. Of course, you will see a lot of military and police presence, but I don't think it's meant to actually intimidate people. We're only encouraging people to go out and vote because it's their right. We encourage everybody that's registered, that's in Sierra Leone, to go out and vote on that day. Nobody should fear the police. Nobody should fear anything, really.
Mr. Chairman, when do you expect to announce the final outcome of the presidential runoff vote, particularly when in the first round it took a little bit of time for the Electoral Commission to come out and announce the result?
Well, in the first round, it only took 6 days, unlike previous years. It took 2 years, but this time around, we want to ensure that we announce the result as soon as possible and in a matter of days, less than the 6 days earlier on I talked about.
During the first round of voting, a lot of the political parties expressed concern about overvoting. Some said there were voter irregularities. You said you have implemented measures. The Electoral Commission officials ensured transparency and credibility of the election. What should Sierra Leoneans expect?
The Sierra Leoneans, as I said, should expect well-planned elections, credible elections. Even the irregularities you're talking about, yes, there were very few irregularities. There are irregularities, but these are so few that they had very little or nothing to do with the credibility of the results we announced. That I can assure everybody, I can assure the whole world, right? So We've taken measures, to deal with these, some of these irregularities. And then Sierra Leonean, as I say, to expect well-planned elections with their cooperation and credible ones.
Both local and international poll observers said the elections were free, fair, and transparent. Should Sierra Leoneans expect anything less?
No, they should not expect anything less. That's why, in fact, they should expect better planned elections and still credible ones, free, fair, and transparent. They should not fear anything. Sierra Leoneans should go out and vote because it is their right. It's their right to select their leader, their next president for the next 5 years. They should go out and exercise that right. I encourage them to do so. I encourage every Sierra Leonean to do so. We have committed ourselves to conduct credible elections.
What is your message to Sierra Leoneans as they vote throughout Saturday?
My message to them is that all Sierra Leoneans must go out, obey rules and regulations, obey the law, to go out and vote in a very peaceful and orderly manner. Once again, we want to assure every Sierra Leonean and non-Sierra Leonean outside, in and outside Sierra Leone, of credible elections.
Mohamed Infa-Ali Konte is the chairman for the Sierra Leonean National Electoral Commission. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. Angolan President João Lourenço has become popular following his ongoing crackdown on corruption. But local media reports the president's graft fight is creating tension between him and former President Eduardo dos Santos. The tension came after the former president's daughter and son were removed from top positions in two separate state institutions. The former president also cautioned against implementing reforms too quickly. Alcide Sakala, the spokesman for the Angolan main opposition party, UNITA, told me Angolans want President Lourenço to be undeterred in his commitment in the fight to weed out corruption.
Our overarching objective or goal was to give every Congolese and all age and social background a voice in a political conversation that's mainly dominated by Congolese elite and foreign experts. So we really wanted to give the population a voice. And what we saw...
fight against corruption, it has been our position throughout the years. And from the statements of the new Angolan president last year, he showed the will indeed to fight corruption. And our assessment is that he has picked up part of our strategy, of our message against corruption. We don't see any problem on this particular point because we are encouraging the fight for corruption, because the corruption in Angola has been institutionalized and is the main factor of the poverty in our country. And it may become, if not stopped, the source of a new conflict in Angola, particularly within the ruling party.
The daughter of the former president, Isabel dos Santos, said the firing from Sanangol and Mr. Filomeno, they have become victims of the fight against corruption. Basically, they are being witch-hunted. That is the stance Isabella has taken. What is your reaction to that?
I don't think they are victims. They are real people responsible for corruption within the Sanangol system, as you know. The new leadership of Sonangol has pointed out so many negative things as far as Isabel dos Santos is concerned. Now, I think that's the role of the justice of the Angolan government to keep up with this process. The court have to take a clear position on the following and take decisions as far as problems related with corruption towards Isabel, his brother Zenu, and the others in the country. I think the courts have to look for this and to take a final decision. If you are responsible, they have to be dealt with.
There have been reports in the local Angolan media that there is tension between former President Eduardo dos Santos and current President João Lourenço as a result of the current president's fight against corruption. Is this true, and what is your party's reaction to that?
We have been following carefully this situation. The debate, as far as we are concerned, and from what we are hearing from within, most of the people within the party, they think that Dos Santos should be should leave, so that João Lourenço, the new president, can put into practice his philosophy. Dos Santos, he has promised, I think maybe 2 years ago, that in 2018 he will be leaving power. Now he is the leader of the party, and the party is the party that decides the strategies for the government. And you see, there is a climate of a permanent tension. João Lourenço, he wants to keep up with what he has promised, but when he gets in the party, I think he finds let us put this way, some obstacle put forward is flawed. So now there is this climate of tension. We have been following, we have been encouraging that leaders from MPLA, they should find the best way to solve this problem. Because whatever affects the ruling party will affect also the country as a whole.
Isabel Dos Santos said split within the ruling MPLA is fake news, and that it is intended by people like your party, UNITA, to split the MPLA gathering, insisting that such things don't happen on our side. How do you respond to that?
Well, that's not true. We are just getting all information from within. Today, they speak on about millions. The corruption is so high that today they are talking among themselves, you know, who has stolen more than the other. So there is really a very complex situation, because João Lourenço, it seems that the country has no money. So even the national debt is so high that is more than 50% of the budget that has approved recently in the National Assembly.
Alcide Sakala is the spokesman for the Angolan main opposition party, UNITA. He spoke with me from the capital, Luanda. A new survey conducted in the Democratic Republic of Congo, DRC, shows that 8 in 10 Congolese have a negative opinion of President Joseph Kabila. It also showed doubt about the credibility of the December vote to replace the president. Conducted last month by the Congolese polling firm BESI in conjunction with the Congo Research Group at New York University, measured the country's mood ahead of the scheduled December 23rd elections. To learn more about the latest poll, I reach Francisca Bomboko, the head of the Congolese polling group BESI.
Our overarching objective, our goal, was to give every Congolese and all age and social background a voice in a political conversation that's mainly dominated by Congolese elite and foreign experts. So we really wanted to give the population a voice. And what we saw was an overwhelming majority. The support of the democratic process is very strong. More and more people believe that this time the election will happen. But public opinion in general are in favor of most of the opposition positions.
So what was the mood politically in the country, since you seem to suggest that the Congolese were optimistic about elections happening this year, despite the president not really saying or stating that he's going to step out?
Absolutely. And it's been consistently increasing. You know, I think over 50%, the majority of the people today believe that it's going to happen this year. As you saw in the poll, they were like 32% in last August, and now they're 59%.
What was the favorability rating of President Joseph Kabila if elections were to be held, as your poll found out?
There's two questions that actually address that issue. One, what is the favorability rating, like you say, which we call good opinion in general? So this is something that we've been following President Kabila since when he took over, since 2001. And it's very, very, very low. Only 20%, you know, have a favorable opinion about him versus 80% that, you know, have a very, very bad opinion about him. To analyze that a little bit, you know, from the different survey that we did, we saw that for Congolese presidents, you know, one day the curve of good opinion crosses the curve of bad opinion, it never crossed back again. This is the beginning of the end. I mean, this is at least what our polling have been showing since the late 1980s, 1991, when we started doing that, up until Kabila's father and today, Joseph Kabila. So this is one of the questions, you know, his favorability rating is very, very low for the moment, the lowest point ever recorded by us. There's another question that we ask, you know, if the election were held next Sunday, for whom would you vote for? And he's getting very low percentage, you know, only 7%. And when you cross that by different provinces, you see that he's only managed to be the most preferred candidate in one provinces of DRC, you know, if you look at the overall 11 provinces, because 26 is too heavy to analyze, which is the former Oriental provinces.
Does that mean that there appears to be an overwhelming majority of people who want change in Congo?
Oh, definitely. And you can see that in different ways. You know, even though like the majority of the respondents think that the country is going in the wrong direction, you see that most of them feel very optimistic about their own destiny because they also believe that they have the power to change the country by themselves. This is very interesting. It's a contrast. It's a paradox, you know, against the Afro-pessimism or the Congo pessimism that most of the time that you see, you feel that people really believe in their own ability to provoke the changes.
Francisca, what about exiled opposition leader Moise Katumbi and main opposition leader Felix Tshisekedi? How did they fare in your poll?
Well, I would say relatively pretty well, in a sense like he's still heading the election at hypothetical vote. He's still number one, but he's losing. He's losing ground quite considerably. He was like 38% last year, and today he's only 26%. And we think that his absence from DRC can explain the drastic drop that we see regarding Moise Katumbi. However, regarding Felix Tshisekedi, there was a boost after his father passed, but today it's kind of stabilized. Yes, around 12%. If you look at by provinces, is still number one in the two Kasai regions. And most of the Kasai provinces, his father's party, UDPS, which is his own party, of course, is still number one, and he is the overwhelming preferred candidate in those areas.
What were the takeaways of this polling that you conducted?
The takeaway of this polling is like most people actually really support, you know, the New Year's Eve agreement. The full implementation of the New Year's Eve agreement. This is one of the main takeaways. They still believe in it. Most people believe that this time, this is it. Election will happen in December. And a third takeaway that I would say, I mean, if the election were to happen in a credible way, transparent way, you know, I would say the current presidential majority will become a minority.
Francisca Bomboko is the head of the Congolese polling group Bercy. She spoke with me from the Belgian capital, Brussels. The Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni has ordered the transfer of crime preventers from police to the National Army. The president said the crime preventers, who have been working as vigilantes by giving information on crime to police, will now be a reserve force, an auxiliary force of the army. The move has provoked sharp criticisms from various security experts and observers. Wilfred Nwagaba is an independent Ugandan member of parliament. For reaction, my colleague Douglas Mpuga reached him by phone in the southwestern Ugandan town of Kabale.
It's a very unfortunate pronouncement in the sense that he has always talked about professionalizing the army, but is now bringing hardcore criminals and thugs to the army. And that shows you how all state institutions have not only been captured but dismantled by the man, simply because his major interest is to retain the power at all costs.
What's the status of this in law? Is he allowed to create a militia of that magnitude? Has Parliament got a role to play in this?
Definitely, they are not covered under the UPDF Act. He has no authority to create an army on his own without sanction of a neighboring law, but because he believes the country is his personal and real estate, personal estate, he does what he wants. That's why he has no sense of shame of calling fellows whom Ugandans have accused of brutality, of violence, of all manner of things, but he declares them a reserve force.
These crime preventers have been widely, as you say, accused of abetting and perpetrating crime. He seems now to have given even those criminals cover. How does this one work now?
Well, on normally works in his favor simply because whatever they do, as long as they do not endanger his continued stay in power, you can't do anything in this country. That's why he tolerates the corrupt, he tolerates the criminals, as long as none threatens his continued stay in power. But I hope Ugandans will not allow this kind of pronouncement to go unchallenged.
What next now? Does he have a reserve force of almost 11 million people?
Fortunately enough, I don't see how he's going to make it tractable other than continuing to give them handouts as he has already done. But as far as the laws are concerned, that's not a reserve force within the meaning of the law. But I know he has used them before for his campaigns. He will still, of course, use them again in the next election, if at all the elections are there. But I believe soon rather than later, when we finally get rid of him, we will bring back sanity.
Wilfred Nuwagaba is an independent Ugandan member of parliament. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Impuga from Kabale, southwestern Uganda. Pressure continues to mount on Malawian Finance Minister Godol Gondwe to resign over allegations of fraudulently allocating money to pro-government parliamentarians. He's accused of disbursing about $6 million as a reward to 86 MPs who voted against electoral reforms opposed by the government. But Gondwe says there was nothing wrong with the allocation. For VOA, Lamek Masina reports from the commercial capital, Blantyre.
Civil society organizations, or CSOs, started to call for Gondwe's resignation early this month after a local newspaper reported on the allocations. They say they are concerned with the lack of transparency which has surrounded the whole issue. The pressure mounted when some opposition MPs withdrew from the list of beneficiaries after the CSOs accused them of being among those accepting bribes. The CSOs recently met with Gondwe, but say he failed to clarify the source and use of funds. Charles Gajoloweka is one of the CSO leaders pushing for Gondwe's resignation.
There is indeed nothing new that we got from the Minister of Finance, and our conviction is that what has been the public domain is exactly what we also got from the minister.
Normally, in Malawi, the government can persuade the head of the parliament to allot funds through a transparent budgetary process. It is not considered to be constitutional for the money to be given by the cabinet minister. Gondwe said the money came from taxes, grants and borrowing, and was saved from the readjustments of the 2017-2018 budget that saw cuts to the development budget. Earlier, he said the money will not be given directly to the members of parliament, but would go to individual projects in various constituencies. He said the funds will be channeled through local government authorities in their respective constituencies. Gajoloweka says during their latest meeting, Gondwe changed tune.
But when we met the minister, we were informed that it is no longer going to be the Ministry of Local Government then channeling these resources to district councils, but rather that this money will be centrally managed by the government, and we do not know up to now which ministry and what central government structure.
The NGOs suspect that the money given to the selected MPs is a way of appeasing those who voted against the electoral reforms bill during last sitting of parliament. The bribes were aimed at a package of constitutional reforms which were not passed that would have changed electoral laws. They proposed a 50+1 system which requires a presidential candidate to gain more than half of the vote. Current president just needs highest number of votes. The new laws would mandate runoffs if none of the candidates gets more than half of the total vote. Gondwe told local radio this week that he will not resign because he has done nothing wrong.
Unless they prove that we acted illegally, there's no point in my resigning. And they failed to prove that we acted illegally.
Gondwe says he believed the call for his resignation is politically motivated.
Yeah, they are being influenced by the political people. There was no doubt about that. So if the politicians want that, let's meet in parliament.
Opposition political parties are calling for authorities to call for an emergency sitting of parliament to discuss the matter. Leonard Menges is the spokesperson for Malawi Parliament. He says the call is not viable.
the meeting of parliament has a cost. And then we have also to know that parliament will be meeting as early May for the budget. And I don't see how an emergency meeting can be held now, and then they are also called for parliament.
Meanwhile, civil society organizations plan demonstrations on April 27 should Gondwe fail to resign. State House spokesman Ngeme Galilani told a local daily recently that he found the call for the Minister of Finance to resign or get fired on the basis of the project funds allocations completely ridiculous. In the meantime, the government has also offered to take the allocated money and offer a portion to all MPs. Several opposition MPs have said they want no part of it. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, presidential primaries are likely to be held during the last 6 months of 2018, ahead of next year's Nigerian general election. Incumbent President Muhammadu Buhari, who was elected in 2015, will could seek re-election, although he has yet to declare his intentions to contest. The winner of the presidential election is scheduled to be inaugurated on May 29, 2019. Meanwhile, the League of Democratic Women, an NGO, has embarked on a campaign to educate voters as part of an effort to ensure polls are successful. Professor Kingsley Mohalu seeks to run as a presidential candidate in the Nigerian election. He joins me live in the VOA studio here in Washington. Hello, Prof. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Well, so apart from having the academic credentials or qualifications, do these qualifications you have make you uniquely qualified to become Nigeria's next president?
To be president, you need a combination of qualifications. First of all, I think it's character. You have to have a basic level of integrity. I think you need to have competence. You need to be capable. And you need to have a track record.
But do you have the track record?
I do. I was deputy governor of the Central Bank of Nigeria for 5 years, and I played a leadership role in the management of Nigeria's economy. And we had very good success with reforms in the banking sector and with fighting inflation, macroeconomic stability. I spent 17 years in the United Nations, working from entry-level officer to the highest career rank of director. So both globally and nationally, and of course, intellectually, I dare say I have distinguished myself.
But realistically, what do you think your chances are? Looking at the titans,
yes,
the PDP, the main opposition party, the ruling APC led by incumbent President Muhammadu Buhari, although he has yet to decide whether to run or not. Do you think you have what it takes to be these titans in next year's elections?
Certainly. I mean, I think you might want to recall the story of David and Goliath. We know how it all ended. So the fact that people, in fact, that's the reason why I am likely to win, because the performance of all these so-called Goliaths has been abysmal. They are the ones who brought Nigeria to where it is today. Nigeria is the poverty capital of the world as we speak. We have the highest numbers of absolutely poor people of any country on earth, and that includes we've overtaken India, which has six times as many people as Nigeria. Therefore, the ground is shifting in Nigeria. Nigeria's people want change. And I'm hoping that, like the people in Congo, Democratic Republic of Congo, that you talked about earlier in the program, they will feel we are trying to educate them to know that they have the power to change their circumstances.
So with some specificity, tell us the program that you outlined to resolve some of these challenges you just enumerated.
My vision is, on a tripod. It's a tripod vision. Number one, I am going to heal Nigeria and build a nation using the type of transformational leadership vision that I have and I'm known for. Number two, we're going to wage a decisive war against poverty and unemployment. And number three, we're going to restore Nigeria's place in the world, which has fallen over the last two decades or three decades.
So with poverty, what specific measures do you intend carrying out?
Yeah. With poverty, we're going to tackle poverty in a number of ways. First of all, we're going to start with unemployment, creating employment for the more than 30 million Nigerians, most of whom are youth, who have no jobs or are underemployed. And that's exacerbating the poverty situation in the country. We're going to create a 500 billion Naira venture capital fund that will invest in new jobs for unemployed youth, and that will create jobs for millions of others as well. So that's number one. Number two, we're going to be emphasizing reforms in the health sector and in the education sector to improve the quality of life of Nigerian citizens, human capital development. That's going to be a huge focus of ours. So we have a number of reforms that we are going to do that will make life much better for Nigerians,
stimulate the economy as well. How do you plan on funding these projects? Because you know Nigerians have been borrowing quite heavily.
Yes, and I have been against foreign borrowing. I believe that the current administration in Nigeria is mortgaging the future of Nigeria to debt slavery. Foreign debt, or Nigeria's total debt, was 9 trillion 3 years ago. Now it's 21 trillion. I mean, and that's just ridiculous. And the reason they're doing this is because they want to play to the gallery politically, claiming that they're funding infrastructure projects. The history of Nigeria shows us that foreign borrowing has never benefited Nigerians, you know, regardless of whatever claims are made about how it is being used. So specific funding, there is a 500 billion Naira a year budgetary provision in Nigeria today for a so-called social intervention fund that has turned out to be nothing more than a citadel of waste and corruption. They're supposedly giving people 5,000 Naira a month who are unemployed. That doesn't generate any wealth. It doesn't create any economic output. So we're going to scrap that and use that 500 billion to invest in this venture capital fund. And the private sector will bring in probably another 500 billion. So that's about a trillion. And this is what is really going to create stupendous wealth in the Nigerian economy, because Nigerians are dynamic people. They're entrepreneurial. But there is no, there's no money to invest in businesses. They take loans at 25, 30%. How can a small business survive paying back 30% on loans? So credit is not the way out of Nigeria's economic problems. It is capital investment. And we're going to do that through this venture capital fund and a number of other ways as well.
Some of your critics are saying you are too young and that you don't have the experience to transform or have a major paradigm shift as you are espousing. How do you respond to such?
Whoever says I don't have experience obviously doesn't know me. I must be living in Mars. With the kind of experience that I've just mentioned to you, having been deputy governor of the largest economy in the central bank of the largest economy in Africa, having achieved the things we achieved, not just holding a post, but actually the track record of what we did, stabilizing the banking system and creating several reforms that were successful. And, having played leadership roles in the United Nations at the global level, how could anybody say? I mean, maybe some people would say, oh, you're not experienced inside Nigeria's politics. Now, that's a different discussion, because you can't say that my not having been involved in the sleaze that passes for politics in Nigeria is a disqualification. In fact, I would argue that it's actually a qualification for Nigeria's presidency, because we want something new, something different, something bold. A radical transformation is needed. The current political elite in Nigeria has shown that they cannot deliver it.
You know, President Muhammadu Buhari rode on the back of fighting against corruption.
Yes.
He is regarded as one of the most prominent people who can ever, they said, fight corruption in Nigeria. And that is why Nigerians voted for him. Now, he is still having challenges of corruption. What would be different if Nigerians were to repose confidence in you and vote you as their next president?
Well, first of all, the fight against corruption is a very convenient way to deceive Nigerian citizens, because they have felt shortchanged by corrupt leaders in the past. So if you start shouting about fighting corruption, but we now know better after the experience of the last 3 years, we have seen that corruption hasn't gotten less, it's gotten worse, especially after the report by Transparency International just came out showing that corruption has increased in Nigeria. Now, what would I do as president of Nigeria that would be different? Let me tell you what. First of all, I will start fighting corruption systemically and strategically. We will start by ethical education of young people in institutions in Nigeria, primary school, education, secondary. So people, a new generation grows up that knows what's right or wrong. They have a different value system. That's number one. Number two, we're going to bring a lot more transparency into the government, into the governance of Nigeria, using information technology, you know, to process procurements, to process budgets. And these are where the, you know, where the bodies are buried in the Nigerian governance architecture. We are going to be impartial, we're going to enforce impartial accountability for the fight against corruption. So, for example, as president of Nigeria, I would start the fight against corruption with my own, with officials in my own government. I'm not going to, you know, first be going for all the political opposition claiming I'm fighting corruption, whereas I'm actually just fighting the political opposition. That undermines the credibility of the fight against corruption, and that's what we see in Nigeria today. So my approach to fighting corruption is going to be very different, because fighting corruption is not an excuse for incompetence in governance. You have to first be competent to govern. And part of your competence in governance is the ability to fight corruption. So you don't have to make a song and dance about it. You're just supposed to do it. You see what I'm saying? So that's what's going to be different about me. I'm not going to be making all that noise, but you will see the effects. You will see that corruption will go down. You can never completely abolish corruption. It's part of human nature.
Let's talk about the issues of security. You are aware of the Boko Haram situation.
Yes.
And growing hostage taking, abduction.
Absolutely.
Talked about the Chibok girls. In 14 days, it will be 4 years since they were abducted. Some have been released, others haven't. Recently, the Dapchi girls were abducted by the Chibok girls, by the Boko Haram again. How do you resolve some of these burning issues in Nigeria when it comes to maintaining the country's territorial integrity and protection of the ordinary citizen?
The protection of life and limb is the very first duty of every government, to protect the lives and property of their citizens. Now, a Kingsley Moyolo presidency would be very different. We will take a holistic approach to national security. We will hope, you know, holistically transform the Nigerian police force. We have 186 million people in Nigeria and a police force of 350,000. How on earth do you think that Nigerians can be secure in such a situation? We need a police force of at least 1.5 to 2 million people who are very well trained and equipped. Number two, I have the political will, which obviously this administration does not have, to enforce control of Nigeria's borders. Nigeria's borders with Niger, Nigeria's borders with Cameroon, Nigeria's borders with Chad. Nigeria's borders are so porous. It's a crying shame. And therefore, all kinds of elements are coming and going out of the country, committing all kinds of crimes together with people inside Nigeria, and nothing happens. So, you know, the approach to national security is going to be very holistic and comprehensive in my government. And I've just told you what I'm going to do specifically.
Now, the current president, Muhammadu Buhari, is believed to be a military man. Of course, he was a general before he shed his military uniform to become a civilian president. They said if he's having a tough time resolving some of these security problems, what makes you think you can do the same? Since he has the pedigree to fight it, and he's been found, he's found it a bit challenging.
We have seen, what we've seen now is that the hood does not make the monk. The emperor has no clothes. So whether you're wearing a uniform or you were wearing a uniform for 30, 40, it's irrelevant. You know, it's your performance that we're looking at. His government has not been able to secure Nigeria, period. I mean, security problems have increased. First of all, they came in talking about fighting Boko Haram. Up till today, Boko Haram is still active, kidnapping people, you know, controlling or, you know, disturbing several parts of Nigeria. So they have not been able to defeat Boko Haram, contrary to what they claimed, yeah? So number two, other equally serious security challenges have cropped up, like the herdsmen, you know, roaming across the country, killing people in various communities, creating a very unsafe environment. What have they done? Nothing. Nobody has been held accountable. And you're telling me that you were wearing a military uniform. That doesn't mean anything. I'm sorry. What matters is the ideas and your capability to execute the ideas and enforce national security. It's not about whether you were a professor, whether you were a general.
Well, the other issue that often comes up, usually during election time, is tribal politics or politics of ethnicity.
Yes.
Which politicians have you know, used to gain power in the country. How do you resolve those?
You resolve this in a number of ways. First of all, it's very hopeful that there's a new generation of Nigerians that are coming of age, younger people who make up a very huge bulk of Nigeria's population. And I want to tell you that a lot of these young people have no time for tribalism. They have no time for all this religious irredentism. We all belong to what I call the new tribe of Nigerians who are focused on citizenship as our political identity, not on whether you're Igbo, Hausa, Yoruba, which the old order of politicians has used to entrench itself in power and to perpetuate the incompetence that has led to increasing poverty in Nigeria. So people are beginning to see that it doesn't matter. After all, go and check the quality of life of people from the northern part of Nigeria, where the current president comes from. They're the poorest part of Nigeria. If you check the quality of life of people from the southwest when Obasanjo was in power, it did not necessarily improve because Obasanjo was the president. So those arguments are just, very clever and I would say evil devices that our recycled politicians have used to hold our political our citizens in bondage. But that bondage is about to break in 2019.
Well, Prof, we'll continue another time. That was Professor Kingsley Mohalu, who seeks to run as a presidential candidate in the Nigerian election. He joined me live in the VOA studios here in Washington, D.C. Right now, it's time for music from our African collection. Uchesna sauti, amenifanya na misi tu. Mambia siokope, alini kipenzi cha watu. Tafanya pati nyumbani, hiyo yote kwa ajili yake. Tena sije peke yake, siokope ya jena wenzake. Tafanya pati nyumbani.
Chilling with you, da. Bikini no fat, whoa, whoa. Have fun on the river cruise.
Have fun, suck some herbs and juice. Have fun, when you me hear my bacon. What I gonna do for you, boo, yeah. Have fun, on the river cruise. Have fun, suck some herbs and juice. Have fun, when you me hear my bacon. What I gonna do for you, yeah. I did be watch, watching you. I did badum, badum, badum. How you think it's nice on you. I did badum, badum, badum. Girl, you know what? Maybe you. I did badum, badum, badum. I won't stop holding you. I did badum, badum, yeah, yeah. Baby, you the rock like Miss Cardi.
Cardi.
So hey, I'm chasing you like my Hennessy.
Hennessy.
Baby, what you do be so naughty.
Naughty.
I will take you to Accra, where the party day are. All eyes on you, on the meridian. I'll be chilling with you, da. Bikini no fata, whoa, whoa. Have fun on the river cruise. Have fun, suck some herbs and juice. Have fun, when you me hear my bacon. What I gonna do for you, ooh, yeah. Have fun on the river cruise. Have fun, suck some herbs and juice. Have fun, when you me hear my bacon. What I gonna do for you, yeah, 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 yeah. Hope you be my guest. Baby, I'm gonna treat you right. And got your body fresh. And I swear I gonna hold you tight. And if you be my guest, baby, I'm gonna treat you right. And got your body fresh. Have fun on the river cruise. Have fun, suck some herbs and juice. Have fun, when you me hear my bacon. What I gonna do for you, ooh, yeah. Have fun on the river cruise. Have fun, suck some herbs and juice. Have fun, when you me hear my bacon. What I gonna do for you, yeah, 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 yeah.
If you're down with me, then move your body.
I go take you go a down where the party day are. All eyes on you under the sun. I'll be chilling with you, da. Bikini no fata, whoa, whoa. Have fun on the river cruise. Have fun, suck some herbs and juice. Have fun when you hear my bacon. What I go do for you?
Dans ma vie, je suis un homme. J'en ai rien à faire de ta monnaie. Non, je suis pas un bad boy qui finira par tomber.
On se fâche tous les soirs, ta jalousie me prend en otage. Tu surveilles mes va-et-vient. Faut que l'on arrête tout ça. T'es parano et maniaque. Tu te fais des films, tu trompes sur moi. Faut que tout soit comme avant.
Mais on peut plus se parler.
Nalingi, oh, je suis piqué. N'écoute pas les ondis. Nalingi, oh, tu le sais. C'est mon seul alibi.
Dans ma vie, je suis un homme. J'en ai rien à faire de ta monnaie. Non, j'ai pas d'un bad boy. Finira par tomber. Dans ma vie, je veux un homme. J'en ai rien à faire de ta monnaie. J'ai pas le bon choix, je vais pas regretter. Je suis déterminé.
Ne t'en fais pas, ma chérie. Ne t'en fais pas, ma chérie. Ne t'en fais pas, ma chérie. Je vais arrêter mes conneries. Ne t'en fais pas, ma chérie. Ne t'en fais pas, ma chérie. Ne t'en fais pas, ma chérie. Je vais arrêter mes conneries.
Tu m'esquives toutes les nuits. Je ne réponds jamais au fond. Dans les clubs, tu m'oublies, ouais, tu m'abandonnes. Trop d'excuses, rien que tu m'étonnes. On se prend la tête, pourquoi tu déconnes? Je veux plus te supporter. Tout ça doit s'arrêter.
Nalingi, oh, je suis piqué. N'écoute pas les ondis. Nalingi, oh, tu le sais. C'est mon seul alibi. Nalingi, oh, je suis piqué. N'écoute pas les ondis. Nalingi, oh, tu le sais. C'est mon seul alibi.
J'en ai rien à faire de ta monnaie. Non, j'ai pas d'un bad boy qui finira par tomber. Dans ma vie, je veux un homme. J'en ai rien à faire de ta monnaie. J'en ai pas le bon choix, je vais pas regretter. J'suis déterminé.
Ne t'en fais pas, ma chérie. Ne t'en fais pas, ma chérie. Ne t'en fais pas, ma chérie. J'vais arrêter mes conneries. Ne t'en fais pas, ma chérie. Ne t'en fais pas, ma chérie.
finira par tomber.
Ne t'en fais pas ma chérie, ne t'en fais pas ma chérie, ne t'en fais pas ma chérie, je vais arrêter mes conneries, ne t'en fais pas ma chérie, ne t'en fais pas ma chérie, ne t'en fais pas ma chérie, je vais arrêter mes conneries.
El Mara Hassan
Ayala Kamura.
I'm in love with Yemi Alade.
That is the meaning.
If she just say yes, I'll marry her.
You are talking about marrying that girl. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you something.
Yes.
You have to double your husband.
Just look at top. You are pushing yourself on top of girls that wear puri bag.
Oh, baby. I can't wait to have it in my kingdom.
Baby, give me goosey pimple with your cute little dimple. I know it lies.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sali, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaite, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, one can only believe the fish that says the eye of the crocodile is rotten. I'm your host, Peter Clote in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In an effort to limit resources that fuel the civil war in South Sudan, the United States Department of Commerce has imposed licensing requirements on 15 of the country's oil-linked entities whose revenues have contributed to the ongoing crisis in South Sudan. This means that all exports, re-exports, and transfers to these entities of any items originating in the United States will now require an export license. According to the World Bank, with oil revenue accounting for almost all of its exports and around 60% of its gross domestic product, South Sudan is the world's most oil-dependent country. Through this action, the United States hopes to increase pressure to end the country's five-year-old civil war and the resulting humanitarian crisis. In December 2013, less than 18 months after it declared its independence from Sudan, a power struggle between President Salva Kiir and Vice President Riek Machar spiraled into civil war. The continued fighting has cost the lives of tens of thousands of people and led to a devastated economy, human rights abuses, hunger, and malnutrition. One-third of the population has been displaced by the violence, nearly 2 million internally, and more than 2 million who have fled to neighboring countries. The 15 entities include South Sudan's Ministries of Mining and Petroleum and state oil firm Nile Petroleum. Also included are Dar Petroleum Operating Company, oil distributor Nayakek and Sons, Greater Pioneer Operating Company, Juba Petrotech Technical Services, and Sud Petroleum Operating Company. The listed entities are a source of substantial revenue for the government of South Sudan, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert. Unfortunately, the South Sudanese government and corrupt official actors use this revenue to purchase weapons and fund irregular militias that undermine the peace, security, and stability of South Sudan, rather than support the welfare and current emergency food needs of the South Sudanese people. The government of South Sudan can do better, said Heather Nauert. As the largest donor of aid to South Sudan, the United States is proud to uphold humanitarian values and deliver vital assistance. The government of South Sudan must not squander that generosity and should take concrete steps to provide for the vast needs of the South Sudanese people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.